Oh, college. Doctor, lawyer. Why don't you let them get an honest job? Listen to me. Listen to me. God may have plans for your children totally different. He had different plans for Abraham's children. Do you see how... And then, listen, as if that weren't bad enough, you want to see some real faith? You want to see some real faith? Verse 8. After God tells him, someday you'll have this land, but for now, tent, baby, tent. No possession. By the way, your descendants, they're going to leave the land and go to a foreign land. They're going to be bad, bad treated there. Now, Abraham, if you're really with me in this, if you really trust me, if you really believe this, verse 8, and he gave him the covenant of circumcision. Beloved, that is incredible faith. God asked that man to act on his promises to circumcise himself, being 99 years old when this happened, when God brought him to this point in the story. 99 years old, when God has told him very little that's good to hear. And I say that to our shame. To many of us in here, we need to regroup where we are with the Lord. Nonetheless, Abraham accepted, unbelievably, he accepted this physical token of circumcision for himself, and in doing so, for all his descendants. May I just be a little... He added to their plight. Not only are they going to be out of the land and suffer, but all of them are going to have to be circumcised. And Abraham made the commitment. I love this guy. He excites my imagination. Abraham would have never even gotten this close at the beginning of God's call. Notice that God called him to do the greatest feats after he had had time to walk with him. But there's a problem here, and I want to show it to you. There's a simple error that God has made. I say that with tongue in cheek. I hope you all realize. And this, if we could have the lights over there. And this blunder that God has made with the time that the Jews dwelt in Israel, in Egypt, and the length of time of their persecution. This verse, along with Genesis 15, along with the book of Galatians chapter 3, around verse 17, and Genesis chapter 12, have caused great consternation amongst people that come to the Bible to do chronological works. And the reason is, in Exodus chapter 12, verses 40 and 41, it talks about 430-year period. But in Genesis chapter 15, verse 13, it talks about a 400-year period. And so does this particular verse that we just looked at. And the question is, how do you handle such a problem? And it's created great consternation. Having done the work myself, it's really very simple. And the first clue, listen to me, to showing you how to understand a problem that, quote, great THDs have argued about for years and the rabbis, da-da-da-da-da-da, all right, is can you read? Okay? All right, are you ready for this? Because I'm going to show you the first clue. Look at verse 6 in your Bible. Notice, God spoke in this way that His seed... Now, you see the word seed there? This is plural. Now, we're actually talking about Abraham's descendants. And you can tell that if you keep reading, because it says that they should bring them into bondage. Can you all see that? Good, good. All right. So, the key word is we're speaking of Abraham's seed. Look at the chart on the overhead. God gave the covenant to Abraham in 1921 B.C. It was 30 years from that time before Isaac was born and subsequently weaned. The weaning of Isaac is a very critical story in the Bible. Some of you should wonder why it's there. You know what I mean? There it is, and Ishmael mocks him, right? So what was so important about it? And why did God waste, quote, space? Because in the Israeli family, weaning was a major happening for the child, especially a son. He went from infancy into becoming named, if he was the firstborn, at that point is when he became the heir. At that ceremony, he would become the heir. In other words, until then, Ishmael was the apparent heir. He was Abraham's, quote, son. All right? When you do the math to it and check it out, there's a peculiarity that I've just got to share with you. You know, Sarah was 90 and Abraham was 100 when Isaac was born. Remember, they named him Isaac because it means laughter. That everyone that heard such a wild story of a 90-year-old woman breastfeeding would laugh. You know, and that a 100-year-old man could sire a child. And so at first, of course, Sarah laughed in disbelief. Abraham laughed out of joy and faith. But then when God confronted her, He brought her to laugh. And so she named him Laughter. That's what Isaac means, laughter. Because if you were in the family and you went over to see this old woman with this brand new baby, you'd laugh. The math is pretty certain. He was 5 years old before they weaned him. In other words, they were old and they had this last child and they just didn't want to take it away from him. Okay, now those of you in here, most of you in here haven't been around large families. But when you start getting large families and all of a sudden it becomes apparent that this one is the last. This, you know, whatever it is, 7th, 8th, 12th. This is the last of the Mohicans. You know, the last of the family. Well, the kid hardly ever learns to walk. All the brothers and sisters carry him. You know, he's 14 months old and still not walking, you know, because no one will let his feet hit the ground. Well, in effect, that's what we had with Isaac insofar as Abraham. So get it. Ishmael was 13 when Abraham was circumcised and the baby was born. Isaac was born a year later. So Ishmael is 14 years older than Isaac. Isaac is weaned at age 5. Ishmael is 19. I.e., now do you understand why God held him very accountable for his actions? Now, notice also, this is good. This is part of the mocking. Not only was he envious and jealous, because he sees and realizes that it's at this moment that he is going to be set aside as an heir. First of all, you can't... I wish we had a 5-year-old in here right now. I'd like for you to see how big a 5-year-old is. Walking around, you know, this is the day of the weaning. Walking around, trying to get up to Sarah. And Sarah keeping him away. Want milk. Okay? And we have this 19-year-old ridiculing him and mocking him. Okay? Now here's the point. I could give you a whole discourse on it, really. Ishmael was called Abraham's son until that day. Not another time is he called his son. Never again. This is the day. And so, 30 years after the covenant with Abraham, Isaac is 5 years old, and he becomes the promised seed. And it's from that point that there's 400 years left until Moses leads them out of Egypt. All right? So the key there is, see, in other words, what do we do with the 430? That's simple. It said in that verse 6 that Abraham's seed would sojourn 400 years. The day he became the promised seed was the day of the weaning when he was officially named the heir, the son. And from that time until Moses led them out in 1491 B.C., is a 400-year span, there to there, 400 years. So that actually, when you do Bible chronology, believing the Bible literally, they were only 215 years in Egypt. So part of their sojourn was in Canaan, and part of the sojourn was in Egypt. 215 years in Egypt, 185 years in Canaan. Now, I want to show you something about the verse to help you understand it a little better. This verse is what I call an introversion. An introversion, okay? Let me show you what I mean. Abraham's, I'm going to call this line A. Abe's seed, okay, would sojourn in a foreign land. Now watch the introversion. Be number one. That they would be in bondage. The people in that land would bring them in a bondage. Number two, this is the introversion. And that they would ill treat them. They would persecute them. Then, the last part of the sentence goes back to the first part, is another A. Here, he says, 400 years. Now, let me tell you what we mean by an introversion. The first part and the last part are connected and speak of each other. In other words, let's read it. Abe's seed would sojourn in a foreign land 400 years. It does not say they're going to Egypt for 400 years. They're going to be in a foreign land. In other words, Canaan was a foreign land for them. They did not possess anything until Moses led them out and Joshua led them in. And then they defeated the Canaanites. All right? But the whole time, up until then, they were strangers and pilgrims. They were foreigners. They owned nothing. Now, what he's saying is, Abe's seed that's going to be in a foreign land for 400 years, they're going to be in bondage and they're going to be persecuted, but God didn't tell them. He is not saying 400 years of persecution. It's called an introversion. Once you see it, the Bible's got lots of them. Okay? And when you talk, if you'll think about it, you talk like that all the time, you just don't realize you do. Every one of us will get to telling stories and we'll throw stuff in before we get to the end where we connect back to the first. Okay? Now notice in verse 8, once we got to the knife part, we skipped along quickly. So Abraham begat Isaac, circumcised him the eighth day. Again, showing that he meant business about that commitment. Okay? And Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob begat the 12 patriarchs. And the patriarchs, all right now, what he's done now, what Stephen has done is he has presented his first piece of evidence, Abraham the man. Did not get everything the first time, therefore, there has to be a return of Abraham. And his whole point that he's building for is, therefore, it's okay that the Messiah didn't set up the kingdom the first time. See? Therefore, it's okay. He's got to come again. He's trying to show them that their whole history of their people is, there's got to be another time. Okay? And so now, he introduces Joseph as proof number two, witness number two to the truth. And the patriarchs, verse 9, moved with envy, sold Joseph unto Egypt, but God was with him. Tilt. This is the Sanhedrin. Mm-hmm. Matthew chapter 26 says that Pilate knew that it was for envy that the Sanhedrin had delivered Jesus to him. You got it? These men, these very men that delivered Jesus out of envy, now have a story being related to them about Joseph being delivered out of envy. He's given them something to deal with. You know, it's kind of like when the preacher's talking and brings up a subject and all of a sudden it hits, oh, that's me. You know, and then we say, no, not me. Must be him. Him, there it is. I sure am glad he came to church today. Boy, he needs to hear this message. Right? Right. And then we become shovelers of the message instead of hearers and doers of the message. Okay, right, right. Okay, so again, his point in bringing up Joseph is he is going to show that Joseph also is like Jesus in a method, in a way. Okay? It says, verse 10, God was with him and delivered him out of all his afflictions. Now, I just ought to talk about that. Notice he didn't say he delivered him from any afflictions. No, that's the kind of garbage that comes out of Tulsa. Okay? But observe, that isn't, see, listen, when you read the story of Joseph, oh, it sounds wonderful unless you're Joseph and are in a dungeon for almost 3 years. For part of 3 years. That duration of time is not glorious. The glorious part was when you were called up by the king. Did anyone hear that? I think I'll say it again. Maybe someone will catch it. When he was called up out of the dungeon by the king, very soon you're going to hear his voice going to say the same thing to you. Come up. You're going to hear the king speak, and you're going to hear him call your name. See, they didn't just go down in that dungeon and say, all right, anybody down here wants, you know, king won't see. No, no. Joseph. Sent for him by name. Jehoiachin was king and carried away to Babylon. And in the 37th year of his captivity, he repented. God brought him up out of the dungeon and let him eat at the king's table from that time on and got an inheritance and an allowance from the king for the rest of his life. Right, the Bible is just, I'm just telling you, these little things just appear over and over and over. And these are sneak previews of coming attractions in your life. Okay? In your life. To sit at the king's table, having been summoned there by the king, hear this, by name. By name. But it says, he delivered him out of all his afflictions. Oh, now, we don't like that one. You know, we don't like it. See, I mean, here is one of the greatest men in the Bible, Joseph. If we're going to list the 20 greatest men of God in the Bible, Joseph's going to be there. He's going to appear. I mean, if I just gave every one of you a Bible and just said, okay, write down who you think the top 20 are. We're going to have a, you know, kind of a balloting type thing, you know. Who's who? Joseph's going to make it. He's going to make it. And Joseph was afflicted. Now, here's a man that pleased God. And how did he get in so much trouble anyway? Well, the first way he got in trouble with his brothers was he obeyed God. He obeyed his father. His father told him because he knew those boys. See, his father knew that they were scallywags. And the proof is, what did they do with Joseph? At first they were going to kill him. Then they had a spiritual moment and decided only to sell him into slavery, into a foreign land. Glory. And so my point is, listen to me, the point is that he sent Joseph to go see if the brothers will obey in the father. And to come back and give him a report. A type of Christ. The Father sent the Son to bring him a report on how the brethren were doing. And the brethren sold him for silver.
That's
Okay? It'll hit you. Now, he delivered him out of all his afflictions. But notice there were afflictions first. Any of you got any afflictions? Are you ready for this? It's biblical. It is not only biblical, it's biblical by people who were obeying their fathers. Okay? And then how did he get in the dungeon? By being moral. All he had to do was go to bed with the girl, and he wouldn't have gotten thrown in the dungeon. Well, not that dungeon. Mm-hmm. Not that day. But there would have been a time that God would have called him to reckon for it. And gave Joseph favor and wisdom in the sight of Pharaoh. How many of you know that's what you need down at the office? How many of you know that's what you need in your family? Al, we need favor. We need favor from God with people. And so I'm telling you that so that you'll know how to pray intelligently. If you're having a tough time at the office or in any interpersonal relationship, the best thing you can do is pray for favor. Pray for favor. That's even better than praying that the guy gets transferred. You know why? Because it's part your fault too, possibly. And you know, if we just keep praying that God will remove all the people from our lives that keeps showing up that we have personality problems, we're not going to grow very much. Okay? It's much more precious to see God give us favor. And then, having favor, us get to work with the person and possibly get to witness to him also. But he said he grew in favor and wisdom in the sight of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And he, Pharaoh, made Joseph governor over Egypt and all his house. Now the point he's getting at, he's driving a point home, that Joseph, who was poorly treated, is going to become second only to the king. You see, he's building, but he's got a bigger bill coming. Watch it. Now there came a famine over all the land of Egypt and Canaan, and great affliction, and our fathers found no sustenance. Now, this audience he's telling this to, they know these stories. This is the Sanhedrin. These men are Pharisees and Sadducees. They've got most of the Old Testament. You know, they've got the whole law memorized verbatim. They've got the Psalms and Jeremiah memorized verbatim. You can't be a Pharisee if you haven't got that memorized verbatim and most of Isaiah. I mean, he's telling this to guys that are sitting there nodding their head. In other words, now listen, he isn't trying to do this to show them he knows the history of their people. Okay? Every single detail is aimed at showing them, and I'm going to let the cat out of the bag. When he gets to his hot licks at the end, he will have demonstrated that neither he or Jesus are against Moses and the law in that temple. That au contraire, they are. And that, in other words, the very charges, what he's going to do with this whole defense is, the very charges they have brought against him, he is going to demonstrate they are the ones that are guilty. And therefore, rather than him repent, they should repent. And we'll see what a wonderful reception he gets. Okay? Probably about like the one you got when you told your dad, mom, wife, husband that was lost, the same similar pitch. But watch this. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent out our fathers first, the patriarchs. And at the second time, Joseph was made known to his brethren. And Joseph's kindred were made known to Pharaoh. Did you get it? He's saying, hey, remember Joseph? He went down into Egypt, the patriarchs, his brothers sold him down to Egypt. He goes down there, and of course, he doesn't have to tell them all the detail. They know the story. Now listen to me, and I don't mean to be unkind. I'm just going to tell it like it is. We Americans are pretty crude. Europeans can hardly stand us, especially our sense of humor. Because American sense of humor, we automatically assume no one is going to catch the punchline unless we draw it and color it in 27 shades. Any Aggie joke, for example, you've ever heard, right? I mean, it is so abundantly clear, right? I mean, you know, there is no way you can miss the point. And the reason, and this is the hurtful part, is because we are such miserable listeners. Americans, as a whole, don't listen. You want proof? Wives, any of you think your husband really listens to you good? You know, don't raise your hand. We don't want any counseling, marital counseling situations after the meeting. But there ain't a woman in here that wouldn't say, you know, my husband just really doesn't listen to me. Right? Well, we can prove, I mean, we've proved that half of the population in America doesn't listen right there. And I'm far too prudent to reverse this. No, seriously, seriously. Europeans and Middle Easterners pride themselves in storytelling, and they tell it where the audience has to listen. I never will forget when I learned it in the oil business, that technique. I was a very brutal man in the oil business. I was lost. And I can remember one time we were fighting about drilling an oil well. And I wanted to drill it in a certain place. And I had the least authority and position and title of anyone in the room. And before we drilled it, I yelled, fought, cursed, pounded my fist on the table, and pounded my fist on the map. The whole point was I had decided to make this the time that I set made the issue clear. I decided that I believed in this well, and I wanted it to come out because the geologist believed I was going to be off by 1,200 feet. And I decided I was going to be right. And I decided to put my entire career and reputation on the line on this one thing. And the issue for me was that if I came out right, everyone would fear to go against me ever again in that company. That if I said drill, everyone said, let's drill, let's drill. And if I said don't drill, everyone said, Floyd says not drill. You hear me? You see, I had the advantage over every geophysicist I ever worked with. None of them understood at all what the point was. Success was not how much money I made or my title. It's when I speak, does this company act? And if it does, I'll get the money and the titles. You hear me? I had no competition. There was no competition because no other geophysicist in that company even grasped the fundamentals of what we're after. I got it by reading the most wicked book ever written, called The Prince by Machiavelli. And I understood the issues. I was a killer. And so, when the well was drilled, let me tell you, it was so bad. Sure enough, when we spudded in, we got down 300 feet. I was 1,200 feet off. I mean, if you keep projecting, I'm going to miss. And I'd go to coffee and I'd hear people talking about the progress on the well. After a few weeks, I'd get so nervous, I'd just get up and walk out. You know, I mean, I couldn't stand to hear them talk about it. At lunch, I wouldn't get around anyone. I couldn't stand it. Because I knew how much I had invested. Everything. One day, I get to the office, and everyone had a ritual, religious ritual. You went to the coffee bar. We had a big coffee room. And people would be in there talking, and you'd get your coffee and talk a little bit, and then go back down to your room with your big mug of coffee. I mean, that was the religious ritual. I walk in, and there's no one there. I mean, this room is always full, and there is no one there. And my first thought was, great Zot, it's a holiday, and I missed it. You know, I really didn't understand what was going on. But all of a sudden, my eye caught something all the way across the room on the bulletin board, and just underneath it was the whole thing was a setup. They'd spotted me and timed it. Here was this big mug of coffee smoking and a sign on the bulletin board.